From TexasObserver.org and KOOP, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour conversation about news and politics in Texas, with the staff of the Texas Observer and its friends. In today's show, which I should note here is our second-to-last show, we'll be talking to Mark Lamster, the architecture critic for the Dallas Morning News and a professor at UT Arlington, about a vision he has for a Dallas skyline that's not full of prisons. But first, Candace Burnt, assistant editor and reporter with Truth Out, and an activist in Denton who's been working on the fracking ban that just passed there. She and her partner, Garrett Graham, are now co-writing a documentary tentatively titled Don't Frack with Denton, about this monumental step that this one city in North Texas has made to ban fracking in the city limits. And this was an issue I think that a lot of folks around the state were watching on election night. And why don't we start there? Tell me about what you were doing on election night and what the atmosphere was like as you watched the results come in.
Oh, yeah, well, I think that we were, I was one of the few progressives on an election night that was actually just unapologetically celebrating as hard as I could. I think Denton was one of the bright spots. Denton, alongside a number of ballot initiatives in the country that actually saw progressive wins. But yeah, we were at Dan Silverleaf Bar, and just kind of when the results came in, I think a lot of us were surprised. I know I was surprised. I wrote an article for Truth Out chronicling the 5 years we spent struggling against fracking. And while I thought that it would be close, and my reasoning there was that every city council meeting or forum around fracking I've ever been to showed always a clear majority of folks from Denton always being kind of opposed to fracking and standing up against the industry. So I'd always seen clear majorities, but I guess I was worried that with the just the incredible amount of money that the industry was pouring into to the election, officially it was something like $773,000 that was being reported. But I think with the dark money, it was likely millions. I know that that had some of us concerned, and I think a lot of us thought it would be a lot closer, the results of the election, than it actually was. And when it came back, you know, with 59% voting in favor, I think some of us were even surprised that it was that much. Definitely a lot of Republican crossover in the election. And I think that in a lot of ways, the industry really did it to itself. Just with the horrible PR campaign it ran, I think for Dentonites who knew anything about the history of the struggle, you know, they know that we had tried quote unquote responsible drilling for 5 years and that it just wasn't working out. So that's what I was doing on election night. I was just kind of stunned and amazed that it was the clear landslide majority that it was.
And was that sort of the problem with the company's campaign in this referendum, that the people in Denton sort of recognized the talking points didn't totally ring true?
Right, exactly. Definitely, they focused it entirely on our economy, and they really propped it up, this Perryman study that was an industry-funded study, and I think a lot of people saw through that for what it was, you know, an industry-funded study. But yeah, their entire campaign was really centered on this idea that Dentonites should support responsible drilling and, you know, should work with the industry more. And additionally, they sent us mailers. And I think one of the mailers that really got a lot of people was one specifically talking about parks, in which they showed a child on a swing, and they tried to make this argument that it was going to take away money from our parks. And for Dentonites, it hits a nerve, because the thing that touched off this fight was the fact that they erected a derrick across the street from McKenna Park. So I think, you know, it was just kind of this completely Orwellian flip the script thing about the parks. I think a lot of people saw through that. They did a lot of things that I think for anybody who actually understands what is, you know, what happened to our town over the course of 5 years, could really see through a lot of that.
I mean, I see a drilling rig out there, and my first thought is park. I mean, I just want to climb all over it, and it seems like a great time. So, like, the more the merrier. So this is also the first city in Texas to ban fracking altogether. So that's again, like, one reason why the companies were so interested in the results here, was because this would be a milestone for other cities. And in fact, on election night, Denton struck a swift and decisive victory for the anti-fracking folks that's going to last forever, and there will never be any more fracking in Denton, and everybody's fine with that, right?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Okay. And this is what you wrote about for The Observer in your op-ed, which folks can check out in the show notes.
Yeah, there's really a number of things going on there, I think. I kind of break it into two fronts. There is the local front with the lawsuits coming down. We're seeing them come from the Land Commission as well as the Texas Oil and Gas Association. And the city staff are very busy doing what they can to defend those bans. Dentonites have been, you know, even after our victory, we were putting pressure on city staff to make sure that they defend it to the very best of their ability, because we saw that in other places, Colorado, for instance, the way that these kinds of bans were defended there, you know, they were defended with loopholes that easily got overturned. So we were trying to make sure something like that doesn't happen. And we're continually in touch with our city leaders just to say, hey, you know, you guys need to, you know, be as aggressive in terms of defending this as possible. So that's an ongoing issue. The city is talking about putting up a website that is going to track the lawsuit process, and that came out of a meeting with some concerned citizens as well as city leaders. So we're looking forward to that, just being able to see what's going on and have some transparency there. But then the other issue is kind of the more state-level stuff, where we're seeing Texas legislators, specifically Phil King, threatening to author legislation that would prohibit cities from banning fracking specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is something that I think conservative Texas legislators have a long history with. They tend to always be willing to sell out their conservative values the moment it conflicts with oil and gas.
This is this local control and, you know, the
right.
keep the corporations off my land. And
right, this idea about big government as well. They like to say, you know, that they don't want Washington's agenda coming to Texas, and they don't want the Obama administration, you know, they don't want anything to do with big government. But the moment that, you know, Denton decides it wants to take control of its destiny and ban fracking, they're willing to slap little old Denton with the big hand of government themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think also in that vein, their values are very hypocritical, because they say that they're for property rights. But, you know, at the same time, as soon as an oil well is erected across the street from your house, they don't care about your right to enjoy your property anymore. They're going to side with the oil and gas industry. But I think what's more damning than them is the fact that the regulator is doing it too. And this is really the main point of my op-ed. The Railroad Commission, supposedly the regulator, also is really slapping Denton in the face. Chair Christy Craddock basically telling the Dallas Morning News that she's going to continue to issue permits because it's her job. I think that hit a lot of Dentonites really hard. For a number of reasons, because this is supposedly the agency that's supposed to be protecting us, and that's clearly not the case. And the reason why I wrote it was because I think that her comments really kind of lend a new urgency to what is an old case that was put forward by the Sunset Advisory Commission. They first offered this report in November of 2010. They revised it again in 2011. And they came out with some follow-up things to revisit in 2013. So it's kind of been a long process with this report. But I think what's critical about the report is that they make the case, and it's a very thorough case, that the Railroad Commission should be abolished. And I think that it's important to remember that now, because while that report might be languishing since legislators didn't take any action on it to pass it, the sunset bill anyway,
mm-hmm.
that while that might be languishing, I think that her comments really kind of give it a new urgency to remember that, you know, even our governmental agencies, this is an agency that's tasked with identifying waste and inefficiency, is even saying this should be abolished. And I think that it's become even more clear that, you know, if the Railroad Commission chair is willing to sell out an entire community that has overwhelmingly voted to ban fracking, then it not only shows you know, that they're willing to protect oil and gas interests, but they're willing to do so, you know, in defiance of an entire community. And I think that that's really critical. And there's a lot of things with the Railroad Commission. Actually, the publication of that article was really well timed, I think, because that same day that my article came out on the Observer's website, Inside Climate News came out with this very, very damning investigative report, which details how two railroad inspectors were fired in 2013 for essentially doing their job too well.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that up because that really is amazing timing. If you know, if there were ever a time to think about reworking how the Railroad Commission works, this next session is gonna be a good one. Talk a little bit about why those folks were fired.
Yeah. I think the article is very comprehensive. It kind of gets at the culture that's going on inside the Railroad Commission. Basically, two different inspectors, one charged with kind of overseeing the infrastructure, frack wells, kind of before they go up, making sure that they, you know, have all their I's dotted and T's crossed, as well as looking at decommissioned wells and making sure that they're okay to be decommissioned, which is a huge thing. Even in Denton, we have a bunch of old languishing wells like that. And then the other was looking at chemical disposal, making sure that chemicals are kind of being disposed correctly. And both of them had been promoted throughout their time at the Railroad Commission, got merit raises. These guys were excellent. By all of the standard parameters that you can measure someone's job performance, these two guys were doing a great job. And they basically kept defying the industry. And the industry, basically, Inside Climate News got some internal documents that kind of show the industry would say things like, you know, they don't understand when exceptions need to be made or when variances need to be made or they're too hard to work with. And these kind of really, I consider them non-arguments. But the article talks about things like, you know, the industry would make phone calls and suddenly violations would disappear. And I think it really shows the kind of culture of lenience that is really what the Railroad Commission is about and what it has been about for a very long time. And I think both that article gets at it as well as the Sunset Advisory Report, because the Sunset Advisory Report has a lot to say about how the three elected members take campaign contributions from the very industry they regulate and how that poses this real conflict for the regulatory role. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that play out with the new investigative report because, I mean, it shows how that kind of moneyed influence is affecting the inspectors.
All right. Well, before we go, you hinted at this a little bit, but I'd just like to hear kind of what where things stand now for the anti-fracking activists in Denton. You know, now that the ordinance is passed, what kind of work are y'all doing to try and make this stick?
Yeah. Again, just we are continuing to open a communication with our city leaders. Right now, we are talking with them about the enforcement plan, which is something we've been really concerned about, exactly what it looks like if a rogue driller was going to drill. What does it look like? You know, who's getting arrested? Or if they're doing fines, what are those fines look like? Are they just going to be the cost of doing business, or is it going to be, you know, something more substantial? We're raising these kinds of concerns with our city leaders, and I think they are hearing us for the most part. On Tuesday, they are having a very big meeting. They're expecting a high turnout because they're reworking their rules relating to older wells that have already been fracked but are producing because the ordinance strictly banned the process of fracking, but there's didn't have more than 270 pre-existing wells that are producing, even though they've already, you know, they've already been fracked. That's not all of the 270 wells, but we have more than 270 that are pre-existing. So they're reworking those rules now in the aftermath, and I think there's going to be a lot of turnout at that meeting, people expressing, you know, what they want to see in terms of how that's going to be regulated. And I think they're prepared for the most part to be really strict because they know how the city feels. I think a lot of the city leaders, you know, they've been seeing these majorities come out for years, but I think to see the numbers, now they truly understand, you know, how Denton how Denton really feels about this.
All right. Well, Candace, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Cool. Take care. All right. Now we're joined by Mark Lamster, the architecture critic for the Dallas Morning News and a professor at the University of Texas at Arlington. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. So we have a Q&A with you on the Observer site that references a piece you wrote for the Morning News a couple months ago. And it's sort of a dramatic call to rethink the way the architecture of Dallas's jails and criminal justice infrastructure works. We're sort of, I think, notoriously right now, you drive into downtown Dallas from the right angle and you're greeted by just a big stone edifice of the jails and criminal justice infrastructure. And, your piece was really provocative in that it suggests that, it says a lot about the mindset of Dallas and the image that it projects. And I'm interested in, how is Dallas supposed to fix this problem that's got itself right now?
The real core issue, which is that so many of its citizens are on basically this schools to prison pathway, with especially young African American men. It's in the city. The statistics are appalling. So we sort of need to figure out how to break that cycle so that we're not dependent on jails to house our population.
I think that's one of the great things about your piece is that you start with the basic architectural critique, and you take it to this bigger point about why we have these prisons there in the first place. Let's start with a sort of the nuts and bolts of the issue. And there's the Dawson State Jail, and there's the Luce Starrett Criminal Justice Complex. That's all right there.
Correct. They sit across from each other, right? Along basically the Trinity. So the Trinity, the Dallas, as listeners may know, is divided by the levees of the Trinity River. And the city is in the process of reimagining that space into an immense parkland, something that will be 10 times the size of Central Park in New York. And how development is to take place along the periphery of that corridor is central to the future of the city. Right now, sitting on a sort of central access of the Trinity and the center of the city are these prisons. Now, one is the Starrett Correctional Complex, which is courthouse and prison all together, and getting rid of that's going to be a long haul, and it's a giant, shoddy, hideous, dun-colored complex. It's inhumane in every possible way. But across the road from it is the Dawson State Jail, one of the most notorious prisons in Dallas until it was closed about a year ago, and now it's sitting there empty. It looks like a giant Lego block, this tan and brown Lego block, and it is a horrible, horrible blot on the cityscape, and it's empty. And really, it's the state and the city need to figure out what is going to happen to that space, what the future of that space is going to be, so we can get rid of it and figure out productive use for that very, very valuable land. And this is all happening at the same time that the city is wrestling with the future of the Trinity Corridor. Right now, the largest public debate in the city is whether or not to run a highway through that Trinity Park, a toll road, a giant toll highway through the Trinity, which has been on the books for more than a decade now. So it's a classic Dallas maneuver to both create the largest public park in America in an American city and at the same time run a highway through it. And if that seems paradoxical, it is completely paradoxical, but that's kind of the way Dallas is. It sort of does the right thing and the wrong thing at the same time, all at once, all the time. It seems that it can't get out of its own way sometimes.
There are some parks in the city that didn't have big public parks, you know, right downtown a few years ago. The Main Street Plaza and the Deck, Clyde Warren Park,
Clyde Warren
the Deck
Park. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and those were big developments, and there was a lot of talk about like new urbanism, you know, and a lot of that coming from Oak Cliff just in the last few years. At the same time, now we're sort of it sounds like a lot of folks in Dallas are getting ready to double down on the giant Trinity project, and I'm wondering if you think that attitudes in the city have meaningfully changed at all towards like that need for a big signature item.
I think things are definitely changing here. I think Clyde Warren Park has opened people's eyes. I mean, tremendous success of Clyde Warren Park, which is a deck park over an urban freeway that divides the city. So people who know Dallas, your listeners, I don't know how familiar they are with Dallas Forum, but Dallas is basically ringed by a noose of highways that kind of choke off downtown. And this deck park covered over a portion of that noose with the park connecting the downtown area to one of the West Dallas, which is the burgeoning area, and it has been just tremendously successful and popular. The crowds are enormous, and whether you love the design of the park in particular is not necessarily relevant to the broader idea that we've seen, that people are desperate for a sort of walkable city, for more parks, for more places where they can gather in the city, for creating a pedestrian-friendly environment within the city. And I think over the last years, based on various factors, the press, seeing more and more projects that like that come along, I think there's just been a real change, even since I've arrived. I've only been here for about a year and a half, but a change and a momentum to try and create a more progressive urban environment. And I think we're seeing it fighting out right now in this giant debate we're having about the future of the Trinity and whether there should be a highway in there or not, which is really going to be in the coming elections, it looks like it's going to be the defining issue, whether you're for it, whether you're for or against it. It's turning into a major, major issue beyond even education and crime. It's really, really, and I mean, that tells you something about where the city is, right? I mean, if an urban planning issue is trumping education and crime as what people are voting for or are concerned about in their municipal elections, I think that says a lot about priorities of the city.
What it tells me, and I lived in Dallas for a few years, and so I'm drawing on sort of the conversations I remember from then, but that the those sort of urban planning problems are so big, and man-made in a lot of ways, and there's also such a big will to do something big to fix them that you can get something like the Clyde Warren Park that really does make a big difference, and there's a will to change that kind of thing, and so I'm interested in looking at the criminal justice infrastructure there, where you see, in your dream vision of what those buildings or that land might become, how the city could reclaim that space and turn those into something that's a little more upbeat vision of the city, and looking statewide, if we're talking about like rethinking how our criminal justice infrastructure looks. What sorts of changes do you think would be good to inform design in the future?
Well, a couple of things. As for what should go, well, I think Dawson should come down, and what should go there should be part of the should be determined as part of the process, as determined through the development of the Trinity Corridor. And there's a lot of development that could be happening there, and there are developers who are anxious to develop there, but I think as it is, the uncertainty about what will happen with that toll road is preventing things from moving forward, because I just think it's hard to get anything done with such a major issue neighboring that site unresolved. So I think when that issue is resolved, the fate of that prison can be determined rapidly, I would hope, and it should be. As for the general issue of prison infrastructure, I think generally this, we need to move away from this idea that retributive justice and to a rehabilitative justice, and I think we need to build. I think we need to stop building these inhumane prisons with our solitary confinement, which is just I think it's appalling and probably a violation of various international conventions, humanitarian conventions, to leave prisoners in these solitary units for 23 hours a day where they see nothing but walls. I think it's wrong. So I think we need to figure out ways to create correctional facilities that are not just housing units, but that take care of mental health, that are vocational training, deal with behavioral issues, over a wide variety of issues to keep people from, to sort of break this cycle that we have.
So, and this will be the last thing I have for you, but I'd like to hear what you think this new vision of criminal justice might actually look like from the outside. I mean, prisons are just such an obvious thing. Everyone knows what a prison looks like in the system we have right now. In a system that's built more around rehabilitation and justice, what would a prison, or what would a facility look like instead?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what it would look like. It depends on the individual space, but I think it's going to be in a place that's convenient to families so that people can get to it to visit. It's going to have it's not just going to be a housing facility. I think it'll have courts and health care and mental health all maybe in one area. It won't be a looming blot on the cityscape, mm-hmm. perhaps, but an active part of a community.
Oh, well, Mark, that's all I had for you, but thanks so much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
All right, and that does it for this week's episode of Observer Radio. Again, this is our second, possibly third to last show that we'll be doing out of 80-some that we've done so far. So thanks to everyone who's been listening all along. Thanks as well to Rosie and the Ramblers for our intro and outro music. Tracy Schultz, our producer, and Jen Reel, who edits the show. Thanks so much to y'all. And thanks to all our readers. You can check out all the stories we mentioned in the show notes at texasobserver.org, along with more sharp reporting from the strangest state in the union.